Accession number 27083, reel 53.
The BP tanker was lying next to the Shell tanker, and you tried to, in your reply to the BP tanker...
I pointed out that the Shell tanker had it right, and the BP tanker had it wrong. And I said that I was trying, in the nick of time, to salvage the hitherto good name of BP. And there was a short delay, and I got an absolute groveler back from... the boss of BP, who said he hadn't realised that that had gone on. So that was that one.
Was the boss of BP at that time Peter Walters, or can you remember?
I can't remember. Okay. I can't remember, no. I've got it in my scrapbook, but it will take me 20 minutes to find the right book.
That's all right.
Well, then, on the day, it all worked out, but if anything, the weather was worse than it had been previously. And the Royal Yacht came out, and she went up and down the lines, and all went off according to plan. And that night, that evening, we were to sit down in Ark Royal's hangar, because there wasn't room anywhere else, for the Royal dinner. And the Queen and Prince Philip and others came on board at whatever the time was, say 7:30 or so, and dinner was to be at 8. And I'd been at great pains to find out from the master of the household, the palace, what the Queen would like to drink before dinner. And I was told, oh, she'd like a dry martini. And I was slightly surprised to hear this, thinking that she had so many engagements that she might go almost TT on big occasions like this. And so I felt my way, and I said, well, do you mean a proper dry martini, or do you mean something out of a so-called martini bottle, which is fairly innocuous? Oh, no, he said, a proper martini, German and French, and shaken up properly in a shaker with crushed ice and no ice in the glass. Right, I said, I got the message. I knew this chap very well. This was Peter Ashmore, Edward Ashmore's younger brother. And I said, well, now, what about Prince Philip? Oh, he'll have a gin and tonic. And I thought, fine. That was that. And I didn't take it any further because you have to have some level of trust. And I had a splendid chief steward, and I thought I could leave it to them. And on the night, I greeted the Queen at the head of the gangway and led her down to the cuddy. And in the before doing so, I had to present the all the Admiralty Board, headed by little Fred Mulley, who was the Defence Secretary of the day, and the flag officers present. And there must have been about a dozen or 15 of them. And of course, the further along the line you went to present so-and-so, and who had to by name, the more complicated did it become, because they were more senior, and some of them had been knighted, so you had to say Vice Admiral or somebody, somebody. And equally, the greater the chance that the Queen had met them previously, and therefore simply gave a broad grin and said good evening and moved on to the next one, and so on. So that was quite a strain. And I ended up, you couldn't get all the stuff out. And it was very tricky indeed, and she wasn't going to be held up at all. And then we repaired to the cuddy. And there, sure enough, was a smart young naval steward with a silver salver, on which was a pony glass with, I hoped, a dry martini in it. And I turned to the Queen and said, Ma'am, would you care for something to drink? And I beckoned the rather embarrassed young steward to move forward towards the Queen. And the Queen took one look at it and said, oh, what on earth is that? And I said, it's a dry martini, Ma'am, which I understood to be your preference. Oh, she said, doesn't look like it to me. I thought, God, what do we do about this situation? And so I said, Ma'am, would you care to try it? And if it's not to your liking, we'll try to do better. And she very gingerly extended a hand as if she was about to stroke a snake. And she picked up this glass and she brought it up towards her mouth, and she sniffed it, and she took a tiny sip, and a look of immense surprise and delight spread over her face, and she turned to me and she said, you're quite right, it is. So that was the first of several rather tricky moments. Then along came Prince Philip, full of bonhomie and so forth. Another smart young naval steward, silver salver, gin and tonic on it. Offered it to Prince Philip. Oh, do you think I could have a plain gin? He said. Well, of course he could, but it wasn't there, ready. So that was the next thing. And to give you an example of the meticulousness of the planning. As the royal party moved from the cuddy into the hangar for dinner, and the plan was that they would enter and go round one way, and at the end of dinner they would leave and go back round out the other way, and so on. And as we emerged from the cuddy, there were a few people, select people, who were lined up in the lobby outside in the flat, who were going to be presented. And one was, and I'm forgetting my language now, the Fleet Chief Master at Arms, carrying the, I'll say mace, but it wasn't the mace. It was some splendid thing, which is the exclusive prerogative of the Lord High Admiral, which was the Queen, of course. Very fine man, you know, years of experience, great big chap. And he was presented first. And we timed all this. And that was all right. And then the next up was Captain, now Admiral, Jock Slater, who'd been equerry for, and a very good one too, for some time, and was then driving a guided missile destroyer. And because he was the only, I think he was the only ex-equerry present that night, he was lined up. And we actually had in the orders, Queen notices Captain Slater, says, hello, Jock, what are you doing here? Captain Slater replies, I'm captain of the, whatever the guided missile destroyer was. Queen smiles and moves on. 15 seconds. And it was all planned. Well, we went the long way around, everybody standing up, and we sat down something like 250 strong. It was everybody that could be scooped up in command or with a flag, except for the Polaris boat on station, and except for one or two other sort of, as it were, watchkeeping sea duties, and there weren't very many. And rank didn't come into that at all. All the flag officers were present, and right down to a young lieutenant in charge of a patrol craft. And so that was good. And we arrived, having gone the whole way around the hangar, we arrived back in the middle at a rather throne-like chair. I don't know where they dredged that up from, but they had, which was where the Queen was to sit. And I was on her left, or she was on my right, and there was the chief steward, who had drawn out this throne-like chair, and I couldn't get the Queen to sit down. And the normal naval custom for grace before a formal meal is that grace is said with all present seated. The parson giving the grace stands, but the rest remain seated and just bow their heads. And it hadn't occurred to me that the Queen would not have known this, because she must have done this sort of thing often enough. And I couldn't get her to sit. And I said things like, "Honorable Ma'am, would you care to be seated?" And she gave me a rather cold look and said, "Do we have grace or something now?" And I thought, well, this is not the occasion to argue the toss with the monarch. And I seized my gavel. Everybody's still standing up. And I didn't know where the chaplain of the fleet was. This was a man called Ray Roberts, great character, who did a lot of time in Ark Royal. Very good man. And I didn't know where he was seated, because obviously he would have got up when I banged the gavel. But since everybody was standing, he was lost in the crowd. And I just hoped and prayed that he'd have the louse to trot out his grace. And thank goodness he did. So we then sat. That was fine. And we had, I think we had avocado mousse or something as a starter. And the fish course was grilled trout. And they were of a size. They were quite handsome fish. They were, I suppose, somewhere, but they were closer to 3/4 pound than half a pound. And they had a head and a tail on them. And grilled beautifully done. And someone had looked up in the records and discovered that in serving dishes on very highfalutin occasions like this, you didn't help yourself with a spoon and fork. You helped yourself with two spoons. I don't know where they got this from, but it dated way, way back, I think, probably before the days of forks or something. Anyway, they dredged this up. And so two spoons were provided, and a silver chafing dish was handed to the Queen, who turned to me and said, "Good heavens, am I supposed to eat all that?" And I said, "Mom, if you care to just take one and eat as much or as little as you please." And she was having none of it. And she seized the two spoons, and she did her best to remove the head and remove the tail and take a small quantity in the middle. And she made, frankly, a pretty botched job of it. And she got the sort of mangled midsection onto her plate and was speechless, because she was busy picking out bones for the whole of the rest of that course. And I thought, well, this evening's not going entirely according to plan. And on my left was the Prime Minister, Jim Callaghan, and who had great naval connections, as you know, and was a delightful man to talk to. And I found myself at one stage deep in conversation with him, and I was I was enlarging with great pride on the achievements of Invincible, who was about halfway through her first year of active service. She'd been operating with United States Atlantic Fleet, and with her Sea Harriers had shown up very well indeed, despite having to compete with the American Phantom F4s and so on. And I was explaining all this to Jim Callaghan, and a slight sort of shutter came down, and he said, "What is Invincible?" And that was an eye-opener to me. Okay, the Prime Minister has to think a lot about a lot. But it did seem to me that for a maritime nation, and with his background and so forth, and we only had three carriers. In fact, at the time, we didn't have three. We only had one and a half also. And I thought he would have known that, but he didn't. Well, I'll move on.
Who was on the Queen's right?
I can't remember. I can't remember at all, I'm afraid. I could look it up. But
because whilst my question, the thought going through my mind is, whilst you're talking to the Prime Minister, who is now looking after
well, whoever, Queen. I mean, I waited until the Queen had turned to him.
Oh, right.
Before I could turn to the Prime Minister.
Yeah.
And so on.
Yeah.
Well, then we left. We had the loyal toast, and we left, and we went as planned, the other way around, and so forth.
The loyal toast is taken seated.
Yes, yes, very much so. Got that one right. And the plan then was that little groups of about eight, all preordained, would form. And after the Queen had withdrawn for to tidy herself or whatever for 5 or 10 minutes, she would do a walkabout in another hangar. And I'd been warned particularly that two things. First, that she wanted to leave at whatever the time was, 2300 or 2315. And secondly, that she hated being told that she was ahead of time or astern of station, or could she be a little quicker with the next group or whatever. She would do it, and you had to leave her to it. And I was a bit concerned about this, but it worked out just. And she was a past master at it, of course, and she did very well. But if she came across somebody, and the groups were mixed, somebody that she knew, obviously she was more inclined to have a chat with a friend, and so on. Well, they eventually... the Royal Party left, and that really is about all I have to say, I think, for the fleet review. However, next day, the RM element of the review was going to put to sea, led by Ark Royal, and steam past. I think he was embarked in the Bristol, Edward Ashmore, who was about to retire, having done his, I suppose he'd done his year, can't remember whether he'd done his year stand-in as Chief of Defence Staff, or whether he was about to hand over as First Lieutenant. It may well have been the latter. And all the other ships, not quite all of them, but most of them, formed into lines, and they steamed past, and he took the salute in Bristol, and so, which was a jolly nice send-off for him. I'm going to divert now and come back to some of the NATO characters that I was in the middle of calling on, and so forth. The Supreme Allied Commander Atlantic was a full United States Admiral called Isaac C. Kidd. Kidd was a remarkable man. He, as a captain, in his earlier days, he had been the Navy boxing champion of his weight. He had now, as a captain, he was a very fine-looking man, very good-looking features, indeed. He now, frankly, had run to seed somewhat, and he was, to say the least, quite plump. He had a very good brain. He had a very powerful personality. He had a tray which, if you didn't know him, you thought was bullying. He used some remarkable language, not in terms of expletives, but just merge used, so to speak. And it was always exactly right. But he had a fairly consistent tendency to call a spade a dirty great shovel rather than a spade, and so on. And many of his senior officers held him in varying degrees of terror, but equally varying degrees of affection too. I pretty quickly came to terms with him and got to like him a lot, and we became good friends. He was a great man. He and here I'm exercising a judgment that I'm not really entitled to. He retired from the Navy after he left the post of Sackland, which was later on after my time. He would probably not have been the ideal chief of naval operations, but he would have made a very good chairman of the Joint Chiefs. Sadly, it didn't go his way. But he was a great man, and I could do business with him. Not always easily, and I shall come to that later on. Supreme Allied Commander Europe was a different kettle of fish altogether. This was Al Haig, who was then a full general, having risen to full general straight from brigadier. He was also, it was generally thought, something of a charlatan in terms of being a professional soldier. He was much more an adept politician dressed in uniform. He had a great responsibility, of course, living at Shape on the continent. He was very pleased with himself and desperately ambitious. When he finally left, having done, I forget what, 5, even 7 years as Sakura, he left to retire. And the reason he wanted to retire was because he wanted to raise money, because he wanted to run for president. I don't think anybody that I ever met seriously thought he would make it for president. But he went on lecture tours and scooped up cash, though not to the sort of levels expected for a front runner for the presidency. And he didn't become the president, but he did become the Secretary of State. Each of these two very senior and very prestigious officers was married and had wives. The Ike Kidd had a charming wife called Angelique. She was tiny. She was literally diminutive. Utterly charming, full of savoir-faire, able to get on in any situation, any social situation, and it was great fun to be with and talk to and so forth. I can't remember Al Haig's wife's name. She was, I can really only describe her as chocolate box. She was, I think, poor thing, pretty shy, and I'll leave it at that. Then Secretary General of NATO was Dr. Joseph Luns, who had been Dutch Foreign Minister and had a great reputation in Holland. He was a remarkable man. He was huge. He must have been 6'4" or 6'5", and heavily built too. Spoke fluent English. Very wise, very statesmanlike. He was a real statesman. And you couldn't not like him. Couldn't possibly. Ideal for the job. He had various eccentricities. An enormous character. He had a gavel which had been given him, which he used at all top-level meetings. And it was in the form of it was almost a tomahawk. And it was about the size of a tomahawk. And with his massive frame, when he used his gavel to hit the table to call for silence, you got hush, because there was a reverberating crash and so forth. He had a charming wife, too, who one didn't often see. I don't think her health was terribly strong. But he was a marvelous man to do business with, and I'll return to him later. The chairman of the military committee, who chaired the members, the international members of the military committee in Brussels, was a Norwegian general called Zainar Gundersen. A very nice, very genuine man, spoke good English, by nature was inclined to be a little dour, didn't have, even when you got to know him, didn't have exactly a sparkling sense of humour, which Ike Kidd did, and so on.
Now, he had taken over from Peter Hill Norton then, who was chairman of the military committee from about 74 to 77. Would that be right?
Yes, that's right.
Right.
He didn't have a very powerful personality, but he got by, and he held the show together, and I have nothing against him at all. Now, as a major NATO commander, I quickly found that the forum in which the real business that mattered was conducted in NATO was a thing called the Nuclear Planning Group, NPG. And this consisted of the major NATO commanders and I think the defense secretaries of the countries concerned, and that was it. And it was in the margins of the NPG that most of the really important and potentially controversial decisions got taken. Although I was an MNC, Major NATO Commander, I was not a member of the NPG, and I quickly discovered this. And having, in my early days, having sounded out Ike Kidd and Al Haig, who neither of whom were particularly keen that I should become a member of the NPG, because it was a good, tidy American shop, literally. But I had a go at Joe Luntz, and he saw the logic of my demand. And then I had a go at Zainar Gundersen, chairman of the military committee. And I finally threw down the gauntlet and said in a formal signal that either Sink Chan was an MNC, in which case he should be henceforth in attendance at the NPG, or if people didn't like that, he shouldn't be called an MNC. And that put the cat amongst the pigeons. And Zainar Gundersen didn't care for the words I use, and he regarded this as more or less telling him he hadn't done his job properly, and so forth. The two Americans, Kidd and Haig, reckoned that this was an intrusion into the hitherto very isolated privacy, and they wondered what would happen. And the only person really in favor was Joe Luntz. But I got away with it. And that was that. I was in. Which meant quite a bit of extra work. It was yet another series of meetings that you had to go to. But it was the meetings that mattered.
Well, Sir Henry, I'll just change the tape here because I didn't have a question for you.
Right.